Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Weed Wongs, the podcast that dives deep into the nerdy details, the minutiae, the ever-fun silliness that is cannabis regulatory policy. And we do it all to help our fellow policy wonks, policymakers, regulators, business members, advocates, and the canna curious stay more informed about the changing landscape of cannabis laws and regulations. Please remember to rate, subscribe, and review. I'm your host, Jordan Wellington, VP of Policy at VS Strategies. And with us in spirit is my policy partner in crime, Andrew Livingston, Director of Economics and Research at Vicente Cederberg. Sadly, Andrew is cranking away and not able to join us on the podcast today. But to our listeners, you know what that means. That means there's more time for our guest to share stories and insights and less time for you to listen to Andrew and I overtalk because neither one of us seem to know how to shut up, including me right now. So without further ado, I'm very excited to welcome a new guest to the Weed Wongs, not a returning guest. We've got another new guest. We have Negust Abebe from Columbia Care joining us to talk about the ongoing legalization in Virginia, where she has worked tirelessly for many years, not just on cannabis policy, but on a lot of other great issues. And so, I'm really excited to talk to her about not only what's going on in Virginia, but how she came to join the cannabis policy family around the country and the circuitous route that she took there, kind of starting doing some cannabis stuff earlier in her career, taking a bit of a detour on some great world-changing work, and then back into what we call taking a break from her other work to work on cannabis because she wanted to do something that was a little bit slower paced. And so above all, Negust, thank you so much for jumping on the Weed Wongs, and we're really excited to dive into the details with you about what's going on in Virginia.
Thanks, Jordan. I'm excited to be here. It's a lot to talk about. So where do you want to start?
Well, I think since this is your first time on the show, I want everybody to understand, like, we've known each other a while, and I know you're awesome because I've had the pleasure of being on a bunch of policy calls with you and getting to talk about how to do things in Virginia, but the rest of the world may not know. So why don't we start, like, how did you get started? Maybe what was, like, some of your initial forays into cannabis, and what did you do before you ended up at Columbia Care so we can let everybody know that you are as amazing as you are. Oh, and for those who can't see, because this is an audio podcast, we now have an extra special guest. So why don't you introduce your wonderful kitty that just joined us on the pod?
Yes, this is Naha. He's named for a character in N.K. Jemisin's Inheritance trilogy. And it's Scritch's O'Clock in the Abebe household. So this is when he makes his standard cameo appearances. But to your original question, so I first got to dive into cannabis policy in grad school for a course taught by Professor Calkins, who was doing research for the Office of National Drug Control Policy. And we talked about Prop 19. And it was very fitting because our conclusions were, there were two primary things that are completely relevant to how cannabis policy is going today. First of all, that Prop 19 had failed, not because California voters were against legalization, but because people were against how Prop 19 was legalizing cannabis. And second of all, that it was abundantly clear that states were going to start legalizing cannabis before the federal government, and there was going to be tension between state and federal enforcement. And now, 10 years later, here I am living that policy. And I did take a few detours into international affairs, and then background to, going from democracy overseas to democracy here at home, working in Virginia politics, which is how I ended up at Columbia Care about a year and a half ago, because I had joined the Board of Normal actually about 2 years ago and was starting to do some work on putting together a coalition to more effectively coordinate around adult use. And I was in particular really excited about the prospect of adult use legalization because to me, it's at the intersection of so much policy. And I think I love cannabis policy because it's not just cannabis, it's healthcare policy, it's criminal justice reform, it's economic development, it's small businesses, and how do you actually address barriers to creating intergenerational wealth and actually like shifting how our economy is, and how do you run companies in ways that are, embodying conscious capitalism, and because you can't just, equity can't be an afterthought in the cannabis industry. It is central to the policies, to our operations, to how you have to exist. And I feel very fortunate that I get to work on all of these different project areas as the Director of Public Policy with Columbia Care.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's why I love working on cannabis policy so much. I throw family law in there too, which I think is one that, and employment law, things that people don't think about. Family law, one that I've spent a lot of time on and are probably going to do a bunch of shows on in the near future about how, you know, cannabis consumers are not treated like alcohol consumers when it comes to parental rights, when it comes to investigations by Child Protective Services and things like that. And so, you know, that it's so interesting that that's what you share, because for me, I stumbled into doing cannabis policy, you know, in 2013. And I, you know, my life has been amazing ever since, because I just love the work that I do professionally. And
it's always interesting.
It's always interesting. There's always something different, and there's always some new rabbit hole that you have to learn about and teach yourself, right? Cannabis policy, when you're a cannabis consumer, you're like, okay, well, they're going to legalize weed, and that's simple and easy. You don't think about economic development in marginalized communities. You don't think about testing regulations and packaging regulations. Like, I've had to teach myself dozens and dozens and dozens of areas of law and policy over the years to be able to be conversant and do my job. And I don't, there's not as many industries that I think touch so many different segments of policy and our lives, even people who don't consume cannabis. You know, there's just all these different octopus tentacles that stretch out. And if you like public policy and that kind of stuff, I think this is a great area, not only where you can make change, but constantly learn and evolve.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that I find like most exciting is that ability to both learn, but also I knew even when I was in grad school and studying policy that I'd never wanted to go the think tank route because, you know, with all due respect to everybody who writes the white papers, I didn't want to write white papers that sat on shelves. I wanted to do policy work that was going to get implemented and be executed. And cannabis, like, especially if you work in cannabis policy these days, like, there's an amazing way to be able to like just think of policy and then advocate for it and see it be realized and see the effects, you know, be implemented, whether it's, you know, in Virginia, we're on the brink of improving the medical program so that we can sell botanical products to patients. And that's like a huge milestone that could be realized before the end of this year. But in order to do that, right, we have to think through all of the following steps. It's not just you legalize, you know, you add a legal format to the existing program. You then have to think about, well, what's the testing bottleneck in order to get there? And what's the regulatory process in order to get there? And all of these other deep in the weeds aspects of policy that need to get written into a bill in order to actually realize the change in a way that's going to matter to patients who need this, who need something more affordable, more effective than the highly processed and oil-derived products.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way to think about it, because I too love and appreciate our think tank policy nerd brethren, but I just can't do it. You know, I have a philosophy. I always, you know, when I'm mentoring young folks, I'm like, if it's more than a page, half the people you send it to probably won't read it. If it's more than two pages, you're probably down to like 10%, 20%. And it's just like, you know, the fun part of kind of being a policy wonk in a more legislative and active role than just the thinking tank is you have to figure out how to get all these big ideas into like one or two pages, because there's no legislator that's going to read your even 5-page memo on something. They don't have time. It's not realistic. Right. And so I love that kind of fast paced aspect of it. But then, yeah, I mean, it's one rabbit hole after another, you know, that you're kind of teaching yourself. And every other year, there's some other thing. Now, you know, we're talking more about sustainability. And then the next week, I'm on a call about sampling and what sampling sizes is right for batches. And then, you know, and then there's also, I think, like almost a community and localized nature of it. Like legalization in Virginia is not going to look like Mississippi. It's not going to look like Colorado. So You have to take all of this business, all of this social change, all of these different things, and find a way to make it work and unique to the community you're in. And it seems like just this endless series of problems to solve.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other aspect too is like, it's not just the policy isn't just different. It's also the politics are different. And like being able to understand, you know, there are some states where you duke out policy in the press. There are other states where by the time a bill has been dropped, like 65% of the conversation has already happened. In other states, a bill dropping is just the beginning of negotiations, right? And that part of like the culture of governance, which then also informs not just what is in that policy, but how that policy is getting done. It's very interesting. And one of the challenges we have in Virginia, for example, is that we have a part-time legislature. And so, you know, actually tomorrow they go into what is technically a special session because the governor called a special session, which he has the right to do at any time. But in this case, he called it in a way that extends it almost seamlessly. So it's just like an extra potentially 2 weeks. That's one of the other funky things is we don't necessarily have a hard and fast deadline for this. We have some wiggle room. And in some ways that's good because we've got a little bit more time. And frankly, cannabis policy is so complex. We need that extra time. But it's also, you know, it impacts the predictability, right? And your ability to plan and how you know you're going to get your policy done. And I think that aspect certainly has lent its flavor to how Virginia is going to be approaching legalization this year. And in particular, you start adding on top of that, not too hard on this, the fact that last year was a pandemic and how much outreach was impacted by the fact that for the, you know, about 2 months, everybody was just figuring out like, how do we survive in COVID? How do we keep employees safe? How do we keep patients safe? How do we stay open? And then it was like, all of our legislators and all of the lobbying we would have normally done was impossible to do because a lot, like, you know, they had other problems that were really important to deal with. And it's hard to, you know, argue about like the theoretical legalization of cannabis when you've got to coordinate a pandemic response and you've got to respond to some of the criminal justice needs. But I think that we've done, and we saw good work laid last year, including in Virginia, Senator Louise Lucas, who is down in the Hampton Roads area, carried a bill that ended the use of the smell of marijuana for pretextual searches, which was a huge milestone and so important for so many people. And it'll go into effect, I think, next month. But, you know, that was like one small step that we were able to get done as part of the response to everything that was happening in 2020, while we also had two different studies going on. And so I'm sure we can get into those next.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk, dive into the weeds of how you've been involved in the process and what's going on. Because I think, you know, like you mentioned, every state's kind of got their own style and flavor when it comes to the legislative process. And as someone who reads Marijuana Moment every morning, like all good cannabis policy nerds should, I've been tracking what's going on in Virginia. But then I'd like read an article where it was like, oh, you know, the bill passed this critical milestone because if it didn't get past this House committee today, then it would have blah, 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 and been done for the year. And I was like, wait a minute, that doesn't like, that's some weird Virginia thing. That's not like the basics, like how a bill becomes a law from Schoolhouse Rock. So I think I just want to mention, like, I think we're all feeling that in the cannabis policy world, right? Because for us in Colorado, where I focus, you know, probably about half my work life, I feel like we're in the middle of like a double session right now. So we had the session, all the work we were trying to do in 2020 that got, you know, derailed by COVID, and then we become essential and we have to figure all that stuff out. And now we come back into the legislative session and we've got to get the bills done that didn't get across the finish line last year, plus the new bills that everybody wants to do this year. And we're in the middle of what is probably one of the most fervent national policymaking times. And it just feels like everybody that's doing cannabis policy at the state level, and most of my folks that are at the federal level, everyone's like, oh my God, like, just if you could turn the fire hose off for 5 minutes, I'd like to catch my breath and get a regular night's sleep. But such is not, yep. such is not the option of those trying to make change in the world. You know, we kind of just have to take the opportunities when they lie. So, why don't we start there? There were some studies that were done. There were kind of commissions that were put together to do reports on what legalization should look like in Virginia. And maybe that's a great place to start the story of what were those reports? How were you involved in that? And that'll set us up to talk about, you know, what's in the legislative session and then make sure we save at least a little bit of time to get into the really fun, nerdy details of what's actually in the bill.
Yeah. So the studies... So one thing to know about Virginia's governing culture is there's nothing Virginia legislatures love more than to send a complicated issue to somebody else to go study so they can figure it out. And in this instance, there was a two-track plan, similar to what had been done for casinos, actually, where the Virginia has this JLARC, the Joint Legislative Audit and Review Commission or Committee, that is an impartial, nonpartisan legislative agency that does research. Kind of like, I don't know, GAO or what is it, CRB, CBR?
It's almost like a governmental think tank, right?
Exactly.
Like a public sector think tank.
Precisely. And so they had And I helped write that bill. It was carried by my old boss, Senator Jennifer McClellan, with a specific lens to address equity in particular, but also a whole host of different issues. And the study bills were separate, and they kind of ended up being, the language was kind of merged. The other bill originally started as a legislative commission, which a commission in Virginia, it would have had members from the administration, members from, you know, the public, like folks familiar with cannabis reform and substance abuse and things like that, and legislators from both houses, both chambers. And that would, that commission, as originally proposed, would have been responsible for drafting a bill. It, that got changed into a work group executed by the administration. And so we lost some of the legislative involvement that was going to be key for making sure that a bill draft was actually created. But we had the work group. And so I felt very strongly that both of these studies were necessary and worked hard and advocated for both. Because we know, you know, coming back to that white paper point, you know, JLR can do all the research they want and write whatever papers they want. But if we haven't talked to administrators, you know, the people who would have to execute that policy, that's not going to happen, right? And if you haven't talked to legislators, then they're still not familiar enough with the policy area. And it's, cannabis policy is very complex. And, you know, there's a lot of stigma, so people have to work through that. And so it was very important to have both. And I think we've seen that because before the week the work group report came out, the governor announced that cannabis legalization was going to be one of his top priorities. And he, you know, included a few key aspects of that, including equity and expungements and, you know, equitable participation, public health and safety. You know, our governor is a pediatrician, and so kids are definitely at the heart. And he also carried the Indoor Clean Air Act for tobacco smoking in Virginia. So, you know, that was going to be a key priority for him. And that was really where the momentum switched, because I think we all expected somebody would be willing to carry something. But when the governor decided to make it a priority, that kicked us into higher gear for this session, which is very exciting to see, but also happened about 6 weeks before Virginia's session was supposed to start, 8 weeks maybe before session was supposed to start. So it also meant all of a sudden we got from like, okay, we can definitely make some changes to like, holy crap, we've got like a whole adult use regime to like stay on top of, which is, again, very exciting momentum. But those studies were critical groundwork to lay because they had some common touch points. Now, they still had some flaws and, you know, they weren't necessarily correct in everything, but they laid some really important groundwork for like, these are the policy decisions everyone has to make. Chief among them was the trade-off between an independent regulator and running this program through the existing alcohol regulator, which is called ABC here in Virginia. And the governor's team proposed ABC because it allowed for a faster timeline to legal sales. And I think some folks were more comfortable, but the moment, one of the first changes made once the bill hit the chambers was to make it an independent regulator, which I think is, in an ideal world, there's the independent regulator is the ideal policy solution. I think in the trade-offs that have to be made, because now they've extended the date of first legal sales to January 1, 2024, instead of January 1, 2023. So there were trade-offs to be made there. And that's another piece that we can get into, is this timeline to sales and why Virginia is taking, is, thinks it's going to take that long. But I think that that work group in particular was so key. And we heard from so many of the administration appointees who participated in it that they learned so much. And I appreciated it because I was able to help shape the scheduling. You know, I brought in speakers who did direct service work with returning citizens, right? And people who had done a lot of work on restoration of rights. Toy Hutchinson from Illinois to talk about, you know, the social equity program that they had designed there, and Amber Littlejohn from the Minority Cannabis Business Association, and teeing up a whole bunch of speakers to be able to touch on all different aspects of equity and licensing structure and public health and safety. And I think that, you know, for any state that's kind of like Virginia is a little bit further behind, you haven't quite had the serious conversation, getting some legislators to carry study work or to start putting together a place is like one of the first things to do, because you just need a few people to start becoming really familiar with this policy area. And you need to start socializing it with folks inside of your, you know, executive branch who would have to execute that policy in order for it to become real.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think, you know, what's so interesting is if someone had asked me in like July or August what the timeline for Virginia was on legalization, I probably would have said something like, well, it's going to have to go through the legislature. There's not going to be a ballot initiative. So we're probably looking at like 2022, 2023. Like, I just don't think anybody thought up until really kind of when that governor came out with that announcement that it was going to be this year that you guys were going to beat my home state of New Jersey to the punch. Congratulations. Good job. Shame on you, New Jersey, but that's, you know, kind of a
standardized talking point. So,
well, it looks for all intents and purposes like you might beat New Jersey because they just pushed their veto deadline back to the 18th. So you've still got nine days in the race. So, I mean, hopefully you do. But I think, you know, it's so important that you do that work, right? Colorado had a unique situation where we had the SAFER campaign and MPP and everything that led up to legalization here and a constitutional initiative that kind of framed this issue for the legislature, educated them up on the issues of cannabis reform and things of that nature, and getting them comfortable understanding that the talking points on the other side are largely based on false manipulations of data. And by getting that kind of study commission together, you can actually educate the legislature, right, before the session starts. Because when you get into these state sessions that are really short and you have to move very quickly, you don't have time to sit down and be like, okay, these are the basics of cannabis legalization. It's not just why today, like you said, it's how. How is so important. How is where we get stalled across the country now. And so, in my opinion, the opportunity to do that, to educate them, to say this is all the ins and outs of hows, everyone may not agree, but that's not what politics is. Politics is not everybody agreeing. It's finding the consensus where enough people can agree. And that gave you the opportunity to kind of get a lot of these issues out of the way, get the education out of the way. And then you're left with, okay, these are kind of the 10 things that we don't have total agreement on. That's viable. You can do that in the 6 to 8 weeks leading up to a session. You can do that during the legislative process. But if you had to educate and solve all of the problems along the way, we would be looking at 2022, 2023. There's just no way that you could, there's only so many hours in the day you can work. You just kind of got to get some sleep. So I think that did really help set the stage. And maybe that is, if we start thinking about lessons for other states, if you are in a state and you think you're starting to get a little bit of traction on legalization, but you're not quite there yet, you know, these study commissions can actually be helpful. Like a lot of times people look at a study commission bill and they're like, okay, basically you lost. That's the same thing as losing your bill is getting it turned into a study commission bill. But I think this is a good example of that actually helping facilitate the progress a lot faster than we maybe ever could have gotten without it.
Right. And I mean, I would even say, you know, understanding other states' dynamics, which might limit your ability to do this through a legislature, even if you can pull together enough resources to have a high powered group, you know, run and start assembling, you can get to the effect of a study commission in other ways where you still have to do some lobbying outreach, but you can still be building the momentum among a diverse coalition of stakeholders who your legislators will listen to.
And so the study commissions, I guess they complete their work. And then the governor comes out and says, you know, not am I just going to make this a priority, but I think most importantly, the priorities he outlined and saying cannabis legalization is a priority, but we're going to prioritize equity. We're going to prioritize public health and safety. We're going to prioritize some of these other things. You know, it doesn't just say we're going to do this. It says these are the problems that we need to solve, which I think are, you know, if you go through and look at what's kind of gotten legalization hung up in other states, it's, you know, it's equity. It's youth, it's criminal justice reform, it's these things become sticking points. And it's helpful that the governor came out and said up front, these are the sticking points we're going to fix. Like, we're committed to these things. And I think that sets everybody off in a problem solving mode on those issues. And so what happened next? What was the next, you know, kind of the session has started now and there's been bills introduced and they're moving.
Right. So the bills, I'll start maybe with where we are right now and go back through like kind of what happened. So right now we have a Senate version of the bill and a House version of the bill. Each of these went through three committees in their respective chambers. And they have, you know, where folks had the chance to amend them and they've come out and now they have to go through at least one more committee before they go off to conference. And that's generally the goal at this point, is to get this to conference because of how fast paced and high volume the Virginia legislature is at right now. This is too complex an area to duke it out in committee meetings over line amendments, which are hard to manage right now and all of that on a bill that's anywhere from like 300 to 500 pages, depending which version you're referring to. And so when we look at conference committee, we're going to basically, you get a group in Virginia, a few, typically it's 3-3, but it doesn't have to be. That's not a hard and fast rule. And for a bill this complex, we might expect to see a different makeup, but typically you have three senators, three delegates, and each of those groups of three is comprised of basically this bill sponsor, somebody from the first committee that that bill went through, and then somebody from the opposition party, right? So in this case, we'd have two Dems and one Republican, from each chamber. We might see a few extra folks added in because this is so complex and it went through several different committees who might want to have their fingerprints on it. But ultimately, the sponsors and leadership of each caucus have a strong say in who's involved in that. And then, especially with a bill like this one, it really is a three-part negotiation because you have the Senate, the House, and then the governor being represented because obviously the governor has to sign the bill. And so the House and Senate don't want to work this hard to pass a bill that the governor might veto, right? So they put it together and they all work through it. And in some ways, this is helpful because you have fewer people talking about it, and you have people who are experts in the policy area talking about it. So it's not just folks who are represented, but it's legislators who have basically been entrusted by the members of their caucus to say, like, you're going to go represent us, you're going to figure this out. And like, whatever comes out, basically, I think it then gets voted on the floor. So once you have that, there are a few things that are definitely going to be up for negotiation for the Virginia bill. I'll start on like the criminal justice aspect. The House bill is much stronger on criminal justice priorities. It addressed penalties for 20 and under possession, our $25 fine, and drug education, which is much better. One, it's consistent with where decrim is at in Virginia with a $25 fine for possession of up to 1 ounce of cannabis. And it's a civil penalty. And this keeps everybody out of the criminal justice system. It connects kids, especially for juveniles. It connects them with resources, so they're getting educated and informed. And it's preventing, you know, another cycle of criminalization and incarceration from happening too early. So I have to commend Leader Herring in particular for the work that she did advocating for those changes as the majority leader for the Dems in the House and also the chair of the Crime Commission. She's been doing like heroic work advocating for these changes, as well as Delegate Don Scott, who is a fantastic advocate on multiple aspects of criminal justice reform. Both bills also include, so that's in the House bill. Both bills include automatic expungements for cannabis misdemeanors. There's some differences, I think, in some of the details, but that is also getting caught up in a much larger conversation because Virginia doesn't currently have an actual expungement process for individuals over, I think, either 18 or over 21. I think juvenile records get expunged kind of on an automatic process. But we did seal records related to cannabis convictions from the decrim bill last year. But Virginia is in a huge conversation right now about automatic expungement overall, not just related to cannabis. I think it's really important. It's really important that we have automatic expungement, period. This is not even a partisan issue. The GOP-controlled Pennsylvania legislature passed these laws. You know, Michigan also passed a clean slate package recently. And all of this is, there's just very clear research that indicates that automatic expungement helps folks get back on track and stay on track after they've paid their debt to society. So I hope we see an effective agreement on that. As it relates to cannabis, that is in the adult use bill, but again, might be impacted by these larger conversations. There are, I believe the House bill has fixed adult sharing. The Senate bill hasn't yet. And this is where, you know, the same way two adults can split a six pack when you go over to your friend's house. This is just allowing two adults over 21 to, you know, split a pack of pre-rolls when somebody comes over without breaking the law, which technically in the Senate version, you would be breaking, not just breaking the law, but a second offense would be a Class A misdemeanor carrying up to a year, which is a little bit ridiculous, for the equivalent of splitting a bottle of wine with your friends.
I think we all remember a time where you would pass joints around and maybe long for a time when we could pass joints around again. And this is almost like a, it feels like this is a COVID-oriented restriction, right? Where everyone needs to bring personal joints. And like, that's how we spend our summer hanging out in the yard. But we want to move back to a sharing-oriented world. I think that's how a lot of us grew up in the cannabis community. That one seems simple, right? Like most states have just been like, if you're giving something for no remuneration, you're not selling it, and therefore you're not violating the law. So that seems like the policy fix is straightforward. It's just, you know, political will.
Yeah. And the House conversation in courts was very reasonable. People asked a few questions, especially to make sure that they weren't creating the kind of gift market, I'm doing air quotes for audio listeners, that happened in DC, which is fair. You know, we don't necessarily want to be creating that type of gray market scenario that can get a little complicated for regulators. But at the same time, again, if I can split a six pack with my friends over dinner, then I should be able to share like my legally acquired weed with my legal of age friends.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, just the stuff you were talking about general criminal justice reform, it's so interesting to hear, you know, the conversation about auto expungement is going on. Where the VS Strategies is running a bill in Colorado related to possession limits and record sealing. And then there's other friends of ours who are running a broader, full-on, not just cannabis-focused auto expungement bill. And so we've been coordinating just the same way you've been balancing the broader effort with the targeted effort. We've been doing the same thing here. You know, it's been largely like, cool, we're going to stay in our lane and try to make, you know, record sealing a lot easier through these kind of technical changes. And we're going to support your bill. And this way, if you guys win, like, we can go home. But if you don't, we've actually found a way to make sealing cannabis possession crimes in Colorado a lot faster, a lot simpler. And we're going to keep pushing on that. And it's kind of one of these great opportunities where one way or another, as long as one of us wins, we're going to make some progress. So it's interesting that that kind of dichotomy is repeating itself out in Virginia.
Yeah. I mean, and this is coming back to, again, like, cannabis policy isn't just about cannabis. Like, we're at the intersection of so much. Setting aside the criminal justice aspect that I just kind of ran through very quickly, let's talk about the market structure. And I think one core thing that I'm constantly on the lookout here is, because the expungement process in Virginia, if they pass automatic expungement, would take a few years to implement. I think one of the most important things as it relates to social equity is making sure that social equity participants and folks with convictions can participate in the license application process, regardless of where the expungement process is. And my understanding, based off of the current bill, is that that is possible, and folks, you know, the ability to get your license as a social equity applicant is going to be separate from however long the state takes to establish the expungement process. Now, the social equity definition in Virginia, one is 66% ownership by an individual with a cannabis-related conviction, or related to, like, child's parent, spouse of somebody with a cannabis related conviction, or lives in an area at the census tract level that is determined by the regulator to be impacted by cannabis enforcement. There has been some talk of how to include being an HBCU graduate in some of the committees. And I think there's some discussion to be had there, because that hasn't been done before. And there's some conversation to be had there with counsel around how that it relates to the equal protection, right, and constitutionality. And so I think that's still being worked out in some conversations, and we'll expect to have that be something that's discussed during conference.
I just want to note, I think what you said there, the first of all, the definitions of who qualifies for social equity is always so much more like, it seems simple, right? Like, people who got hosed by the drug war, only, like, you can't write people who got hosed by the drug war in statute. And depending on which state you live, you might not even understand that more, like, I think Northeast term anyway. But we just dealt with that in our program in Colorado. In 2020, they passed a bill that created definitions for our accelerator program, which we passed in 2019, which is part of our what we're doing on equity. And we spent the summer diving into the weeds. And so when you talk about learning a new area, we had this guy, Jack Reed, from the public safety department, that was getting, like, crazy nerdy on, like, what you have and what you don't have and what data exists and how it goes back in time, because you want to look back historically at these neighborhoods. You want to see what's been going on there. You know, neighborhoods, especially in the Denver area, have gone through a lot of gentrification. So an area that may be wealthy today is not wealthy 25 years ago when someone was growing up. How do you think about that? And then we also didn't want to apply a Colorado only lens. So if you grew up in Virginia, in a neighborhood that was, you know, targeted for the drug war, because that's literally what happened. Neighborhoods were targeted. We want to make sure you're included. So you got to find data that's down to the census tract level. You've got to find data that is nationally applicable. And you can't say got hosed by the drug war. So you got to start figuring out what are your proxies for that. When you talk about rabbit holes of stuff that I didn't know about, like thinking about what kind of data exists at the federal level about free in school lunch programs, high school graduation rates, like what are these indicators?
Arrest rates, conviction rates.
And it's super, super fascinating, especially if you're like, okay, well, we have that. And a lot of times the answer would be like, well, we have that data for Colorado, but only until 1990. And it's like, well, what about people who are older than that? What about people who weren't born here? And you start, it becomes a really complicated puzzle to solve.
It is. And that's where, to point on gentrification, one of the things that I've been wanting to advocate for is having an income requirement for some of this, especially for the non-conviction related offenses, for some of the distressed areas where you're specified has been at no more than like 150% of AMI for three of the last 5 years, right? Because we know, like, I don't want to penalize somebody who maybe just made it in the last year or two of their lives. Like, you know, as somebody who would fall into a trajectory like that, where I've had some income increases in the last two or three years of my life compared to the, you know, years before that. But like, how do we structure this to account for gentrification? You know, I live in an area that that's been a major like conversation for the neighborhood that I live in, the city and area that I live in. And how do we account for those changes in demographics when we define social equity? I think it's going to be a continual challenge. The other piece that I think is important, and Illinois did this, is to build in an annual study, because the only way you can further refine those criteria is to have data and statistics that show that using non-race-based or not, you know, every other criteria that you could find failed to achieve equitable outcomes that based off of what you understood, right? The other aspect, though, that I also think is important to remind folks about is in Virginia, for example, the Black Virginians are disproportionately impacted by arrests and convictions, but they are not necessarily the majority of arrests, especially, right? Disproportionate, you know, is egregious enough on its own, but we have to remember that the follow through of how this is executed. Because folks really want to see diverse industries, but these social equity definitions alone can't address that. And that's where I think one of the things that we talked about a lot in the work group last year, and that is in this bill around the market structure, is setting up a team, not just a social equity advisor, but having a team of people who are responsible for providing wraparound technical services. The other thing that I think is interesting is that the revolving loan fund that's established to support social equity entrepreneurs in this bill is to be run by a CDFI, a Community Development Financial Institution, which is an institution that has experience with how do you help small businesses thrive? How do you know, not a large bank, but a local bank, somebody that is in touch with and understands what it means to provide support services to new and emerging entrepreneurs. And so I think those are two things around wraparound technical services and the revolving loan fund addressing access to capital that are directly addressing like the actual execution of a social equity problem, which is definitely where we see the struggle happens. You can have great ideas, but you know, Illinois is a prime example of a decent amount of work being put into legislation, but when the rubber hits the road and you have a terrible contractor scoring, you know, complex applications and a pandemic, all of a sudden you're looking at a year delay in licensees getting up and running.
Yeah, no. I mean, I would have told you when they passed that bill that that's exactly what was going to happen. And I think that, you know, the reality is there's been a lot of Illinois did a lot of great stuff. They not only shined a spotlight on the issue, but their criminal justice reform, I think, could be argued as second to none. But, you know, it turns out that when you create a system where rich people are going to apply for a limited supply of whatever it is they all want, whoever doesn't get what they want files a lawsuit. It happens every time. And like, everybody who was saying, well, Illinois is going to be great because XYZ is going to happen, it's the worst I told you so in history, because I was sitting there being like, I wish that would happen, but this is how the world works. And like, it just is, it's just a sad reality that like, it's very hard. I think that people, like, it's easy to talk about social equity, but folks who understand economic development and actually like trying to do small business formation in marginalized communities or job trainings programs, like, it's really, really hard public policy to do that work outside of the concept of a federally illegal commodity. It's just right. really, really hard work. Right. And so the idea that you're just saying wrap around technical support, I love that phrase, right? It's both visual but illustrative of the problem. By doing this market intrusion, cannabis consumers will obviously have less competition because therefore prices will be higher. Well, okay, but we're willing to tolerate higher prices and maybe less access for customers if we can get this benefit out of it. We're willing to even invest public dollars to get this benefit, which is a more equitable and diverse industry. But we're not going to get there if we don't give them wraparound technical support, if we don't help folks run a business. I think that's it's so hard. We struggle a lot with the income number too. I don't know what you guys have been thinking about, but like, your instinct is to put the income number as a way to access the program as relatively low. But if you do that, you're basically guaranteed to have someone with no professional experience at all. And then you're going to give them a government public loan. Like, you're going to be unsuccessful. So you have to set the income threshold high enough to capture the people who are ready to springboard, right? It's not everybody, and you're not, but like, how do we make sure that the person who maybe is making $40,000, $50,000 a year now, which may be a lot of money to some folks, they're the ones that are ready to become a successful cannabis entrepreneur. And how do we make sure they can get in and then give them access to capital, give them the resources that they need to be successful? Because that's what we want, right? We want a diverse industry at the end of the day.
Exactly. And that was one thing that came up frequently in the work group and definitely in some groups that I work with too. And is something I'm in the process of working on for 2021 is like, you have one of the timeline in Virginia is too long to the beginning of adult use sales. And I'll come back to that. But one of the slight advantages we have is like, we have more time to talk to the community, to train people, to get people equipped and ready and create a pipeline of entrepreneurs. And not just for cannabis licenses, but also like ancillary businesses. And I think that's something that's not in this bill, but is definitely on my radar, is like, how do we start establishing a social equity qualification that's not just about cannabis licenses, but is like, you were impacted by cannabis prohibition. And like, how do you have a subset of like small business set-aside programs, right? In Virginia, our acronym is SWAM. In New York, it's MWBE, whatever your acronym is for your state. How do you have a part of that be social equity businesses overall? Like, if you were impacted by cannabis prohibition and you have an HVAC company or a plumbing company, you should be able to get this type of certification so folks who want to support equity outcomes and equity goals can identify businesses that were impacted and support these goals in their own, whatever their industry is. Maybe they're just a personal homeowner who needs to have their air conditioning replaced, but they want to be a part of rectifying past wrongs, right? And so that's part of my pie in the sky, or really just, you know, things for next year list, or things in other states.
I'm just going to jump in and say, I love that idea. And if you do get started on that, you know, please include me. I would love to spend some time working on it. I have long made the joke that not everybody harmed by the drug war wants to open up a weed store. In fact, I know a lot of people who own weed stores, and it's punishment almost. Like, working in the weed industry is not some like bastion of happiness. Like, it is a hard, hard industry to work in. And what if, you know, you were harmed by the drug war and want to open up a taco store, or you want to run an HVAC company, or you already are running a security outfit? And maybe you don't even need to provide services to the cannabis industry, right? How can we take those same people and say, hey, this has nothing to do with the weed industry. You know, you run an HVAC company and there's a new, you know, community center being built. How do we get you that contract? Because at the end of the day,
exactly,
the goal, we certainly want a diverse cannabis industry, but I think the real goal is people who were harmed by the drug war, which is obviously disproportionately felt by communities of color. How do we help rectify those wrongs? Like, cannabis prohibition is wrong. It never should have been illegal in the first place. And we've hurt a lot of people over the years. Jobs in the industry are great. Cannabis business, great. If that's what you want to do, we want to help you. But maybe you don't want that. You want something else. Okay, well, that doesn't mean that you know, this person who got harmed should have an opportunity and a leg up and this other person shouldn't, right? They're, right. And so how do you do that?
How do you create equity in life, not just equity in cannabis? And
yes,
to that end, I'm going to hit one other super nerdy part around the differences between the two bills in Virginia, because I think it's really important, especially for folks in other states, because there is one terrible idea that is in the House version of the bill that I don't think is going to last in its current form based off of the public comment. But in the House version of the bill, there is a five-tier model instituted. It didn't just, you know, try to address vertical integration and all of that. It actually created a five-tier model, which basically makes 25 wholesale licensees the kingpins of this hypothetical market. Again, I don't think that's necessarily going to stand, because in doing that, they also took out local opt-out. And we've had a number of folks flag the need for vertically integrated microcultivator licenses, right? Like a winery style grow and be able to sell your own products in your own site. And then also obviously medical inclusion like needs to be addressed. And in the Senate version, medical inclusion is allowed with a payment of into the revolving loan fund and a certification by the regulator of adequate and continued patient supply and an approved equity and inclusion plan that is enforced by the DEI team inside of the cannabis regulator. And I think that's a really important measure of inclusion because it, you know, when we're medical needs to be included in any adult use, because we've seen what happens when you try to bifurcate it. And I think, you know, there are issues in other states that had to do it earlier. Colorado was difficult because you had the constitutional amendment process, which, you know, led to some different wonky stuff. But I
mean, Colorado is a huge problem. Like, we have a medical system and an adult use system. Most folks are dual licensed. And when they put a plant in the ground, that plant is medical or retail. And that's just that anything produced from that plant is medical or retail for perpetuity. The concentrates made from those plants, medical or retail in perpetuity. The products made from them, medical and retail in perpetuity. You've got to have divisions in your business. It's a compliance nightmare. It reduces compliance rates because it increases complexity. And at the end of the day, the only difference in actuality between medical and retail in Colorado is medical patients can buy stronger edibles, more weed, and don't pay taxes. And you don't need two systems for that, right? You could literally just have one store and have a handful of products that are medical only, right? You need a medical card to be able to buy them. And you, if you have a medical card, you don't pay taxes. And we've created a tremendous amount of bureaucracy that doesn't actually protect public health and safety. And so, you know, I love what you're saying, because it's not about leaving patients behind. It's making sure medical comes first, of course, first and always. Always
right, first. Especially that patient supply piece, because there are highly specialized things like the nasal sprays for epileptic seizure relief that are not in high demand in adult use markets, but they absolutely still need to be made. And the other piece that needs to be addressed that is harder is like, or when you don't invest in your medical program, is like there are people under 21 who need this medication and who rely on it and they need to have access to it. There are also folks who are in hospice or all of these other settings. And then on top of that, you know, all of the research on all of the consumer research keeps pointing to the fact that the top three reasons people purchase cannabis, even in an adult use setting aside medical, is anxiety, sleep management, and pain management. And like the idea, this is one of the reasons why I can't stand the term recreational cannabis, because most people who are coming to it, that is not the primary reason they're using it. And we have to, that's not to say that recreational use doesn't exist, but we don't really have a good sense in this country of how a single product can be used to make a plastic bag, help a child with an intractable epilepsy, help a, you know, a parent relax and fall asleep at night, and be used for a good time on a Friday night. Right? Like this is one plant that can do so many things. And there's so many different stories you could tell about it. And I think we just need to make sure we're making room for all of those uses and all of the ways people relate to it.
Yeah, I love the way you said that. I was on a call with a senator from New Mexico. They're working on legalization right now. And one of the folks on our team whose, you know, background isn't in cannabis, he's more of a, you know, he's an amazing lobbyist, great guy, called it recreational. And the senator not our team, the senator corrected him. And she was like, you know, actually, sir, you know, I'd really appreciate it if you call it adult use. You know, most people who purchase in the adult use market are actually using it for some palliative purpose. And I was like, yeah, I was like, that's exactly it. Right.
That's how you know you found the right sponsor.
Right. Like 80%, probably like a big, huge percentage of my cannabis use is really palliative. It helps me relax at night. I'm not much of a drinker. Like, it's just what I always use and helps me manage my day. And then, yeah, there's probably like Saturday night, I'm out at a concert before the apocalypse, which now I can't do that anymore. Or I'm watching a funny movie and I'm maybe consuming a little bit more. And it's definitely recreational at that point. I'm trying to goof off. But like, the idea that the adult use market is recreational is a complete fallacy. The vast majority of it is palliative and designed to help people get through life, which is challenging in modern America. Like, it, people live with a lot of mental health issues, especially younger generations. You know, like, I feel like my parents' generation didn't see it as much, but, you know, millennials on down have higher rate. Each generation successively has higher rates of depression, higher rates of anxiety, higher rates of mental health issues. And like, we know how this works, right? Like, people who have those issues, they're going to most of them are going to use something, right? Is it alcohol? Is it pharmaceuticals? Is it cannabis? Like, you know, and respecting that cannabis is a reasonable avenue for that. And in fact, frequently a less harmful avenue is important, and recreational buries all of that. It's just like, you guys are just goofing off and having fun.
Right. And it also doesn't specify, adult use is clearly signifying 21 and up. And that part, I think, is also important, is like their responsible consumption, all of that. And recreational just glosses over so much and you lose so much nuance. And so I guess just a few final points on the market structure in Virginia. The timeline issue, I think, is one of the biggest things that's probably not going to get resolved this year, but perhaps could be improved, you know, next year. Once folks get up and running, there are a lot of political reasons why the timeline is long too, because there are some folks who are okay with this in theory, but want us to have a little bit more time. And I think that part is something to keep an eye out on, because, you know, Virginia is an interesting case study. And I've raised this, I think, for a year and a half or maybe more. I've been telling folks, like, don't sleep on Virginia and cannabis legalization. Like, there's a way. Now, obviously, I've done a lot to try to help make that happen. But like, you know, we've been headed this way. I've been talking about this before the 2019 election. I was like, if they flip the House and Senate, it's a whole new ball game. And in the last 12 months, we've seen that. But we've also seen, when you have major political shifts like this, which are happening all across the country, just because the electorate has shifted, and you might have obtained a few majorities, doesn't mean that everybody's caught up to speed on it. Again, a very daunting policy area. And that's part of why we're seeing the timeline be slow rolled in Virginia. In addition to the fact that it does take time, you know, like Illinois is a great example of, even when you have a robust medical program, this is a hard thing to execute, creating a legal adult use program and issuing all these licenses and monitoring and enforcing all of them. It's just hard. And it does take some time. And so I don't think we're going to see as many switches flip as quickly as Illinois, but I do think we need to start looking at how can we help that process happen faster and earlier, because the longer you wait to have a legal date of sales, the more people will be impacted by disparate enforcement, the more you'll see the illicit market be expanding, because people are going to reduce their sense of the risk of participating in illicit market activities. And that will also potentially increase, you know, some of the disparate enforcement outcomes and things like that. And so I think we need to keep looking at different ways to ensure equity is being addressed as early as possible, and licenses are getting issued, and how can we facilitate a shorter regulatory transition. And some of that means relying on medical programs, because 90% of the regs you need for adult use are already exist in a medical program, right? Everything around cultivation and manufacturing and safety standards. There are a few things that need to get tweaked or added on or adjusted, but like, the bones of the structures are already there. And how do you keep facilitating medical being a pathway in a way that, again, is expanding, you know, equity opportunities, whether it's, you know, funding or incubating. And so there are a few different projects in the works there. And maybe I can come back later this year and talk about that more. But I do think this timeline is going to be a challenge in some ways for Virginia, because, you know, it's 3 years now until the start of adult use sales and the legal ability to have personal cultivation and things like that. And that's going to be tricky. And
yeah, I wanted to ask a question about that, because by January 2024, you'll basically be like a cannabis dinosaur like me in policy land. That's just forever. It's almost like it's forever away. Like, you might as well not put a date on it. It's so long in cannabis years. And I get that if you want to stand up a separate agency and do all of these things, like, you know, I think Arizona with their almost no time between vote and sales is probably an outlier, even though we're hearing more and more folks being like, how do we get that tax revenue so quickly? I guess my question for you is, does the legalization bill set up a New Jersey style scenario where, because in New Jersey, the only thing that's legalized by their initiative is possessing regulated marijuana. So you have to buy it from a store in New Jersey to get the criminal law protections. And that would be my question, is Virginia setting up a situation where at least people are going to stop being arrested? Like, at least criminalization is over. And I know you guys have decrim, but like, I always feel like decrim is not really decrim in practice. And so how is that transition period happening? Because how can you make something legal but not have a market to supply it? You're being like, well, we are going to keep arresting you guys. It's going to take a while. I mean, that's right. Because where else is it going to come from?
And so in the Senate version of the bill, possession is up to 1 ounce is legalized by July 1 of this year. And that is difficult, because the thing I always worry about with that is possession with intent to distribute clearly defined, because otherwise, and there were times in Virginia's history where the way your cannabis was packaged mattered, right? Whether it was hashish, automatic felony, right? But also if you had a pre-roll, then that was intent to distribute, whether or not, like, no matter how much it was, or if it was something that you had purchased in California and brought back and it was packaged, then that was that could be interpreted as intent to distribute. And so I think if you're going to legalize possession of up to 1 ounce, there's going to be consequences on that front. Like, are people going to get hit with higher penalties is one. And then two, the challenge with that is you're definitely going to see the illicit market expand. Like, there's no question of that. Demand will increase. Illicit market will rise to meet that. Do we risk seeing another, vaping crisis similar to what we saw at the end of 2019? Or do we otherwise set up social equity applicants who will be the first batch of licensees in the Virginia bill? Do we see social equity applicants basically come into a market that's impossible for them to succeed because they can't possibly compete on price at that early stage, especially with an illicit market? And are we setting them up for failure and eventual consolidation and acquisition, right? And that is definitely something that I think, we want to see these businesses thrive and grow for as long as possible. And that's one of the tricky parts, and frankly, is the tricky future for cannabis in general, is we're going to start seeing more and more social equity programs coming on board and online, and hopefully more and more successful ones in terms of creating a more diverse industry. And then you're going to have a diverse set of cannabis companies who are duking it out with the legacy, market over market share and safety. And that's going to be, we're already seeing this play out in LA and other parts of California. But I think that's something that we all have to keep in the back of our minds, is like, what's coming forward is true legalization will come when we have completely absorbed the illicit market into the legal market. And that will be one of the key things in also reducing the actual criminalization of people over cannabis, because we've given people pathways into legal operations.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely spot on. And the question of competition, especially with the illicit market, it is really a tricky one. And I think we kind of see it in different ways play out differently. Like, one of the immediately things I thought about when you said that was like, we didn't even talk about this, but like, does the Virginia bill allow delivery? Because one of the things I remember from my childhood is when I was in the illicit market, man, those people deliver. Like, sometimes you got to go to your buddy's house, but sometimes your buddy comes to your house. And so if you're trying to compete in Virginia with the illicit market, not only do you have price problems and other things, but convenience, this is America. Price and convenience are king. Every single time, 12 times on Sunday. And so if you don't let the regulated market deliver in that case, they don't just have the competitive disadvantages you talked about, but they're also coming in and saying, oh, and you got to come to my storefront, Whereas the buddy you've been getting weed from forever, they'll come right to your house. I mean, the first time I got weed delivered was like in the late 90s in New York City when my dad would go out of town for business and we'd all scurry in from the suburbs to his place and get delivery. Like it's so funny because we've been mired in Colorado delivery politics forever. And like everyone's like, oh, my God, delivery, it's such a new thing. And I'm like, guys, this is not a new thing. Like cannabis delivery is not new. Like,
no, it was the original innovation.
Yeah, it was the best. It was like the best thing ever when you'd page some random guy and he'd show up at your house with Sensi seed boxes. I remember, man, I grew up in the New York City area in the 90s. I remember those boxes. And it's interesting. So is there a delivery option?
So there's no delivery license in the current version of the bill. And I think that, maybe that's a good point to kind of wrap up on for this is, the most important thing I think to recognize about Virginia is like we've gotten, if we can rectify a few of these discrepancies between the bills, we have a really solid start and a really good place to start from. And I think to that extent, if we keep the House's criminal justice reform, if we make sure we're keeping the Senate's hybrid model and make sure we get language in there for these micro cultivation grows and addressing these things, this bill is a really strong place to start from. And I hope that we see something like this pass. And what I always remind folks, whether it's legislators or policy folks or advocates, is like, we legalized alcohol and we ended the prohibition of alcohol 100 years ago. And we still work on alcohol policy. We have been growing corn in the Americas for literal millennia. And we still have to talk about ag policy. We're never going to get cannabis all the way right the first time. We just need to make sure that we get the basics and the fundamentals right as early as possible, because there are some things that you can't course correct on, the course correction will never be as good as if you had just done it right in the first place. And that's things like expungement, the criminal justice pieces, and these social equity licenses, right? Those to me are like core things, and medical inclusion are core things to make sure that the market is going to succeed. But everything else, we can add delivery, right? Let's get this regulator stood up. We can get these delivery licenses, right? It's the future. It's going to be necessary. We'll get those in. Let's talk about public consumption spaces and permits so that you can have a catered cannabis-infused dinner in a private venue, right? There are all these types of future things that we absolutely need to be ready to start advocating for. But right now, we got to get the basics and the most fundamental thing right so that we have a regulator and we have a vehicle and people to keep talking to about this policy and keep advocating for it so we can keep improving this Virginia program so it can actually be as good, strong, and effective as we know it can be, and that we can have a thriving, diverse cannabis industry in Virginia and elsewhere. And so I hope that we can iron out some of these discrepancies and come up with a really strong starting place. And then I look forward to working my, I'm not sure if we're allowed to swear on this, but I look
forward to working my— Swear away, I'm from New Jersey.
I look forward to working my ass off for yet another year to get this bill and get this program into an even better place.
Yeah, I think that that's perfectly well said. I think we see across the board sometimes people are like, well, we can't pass this cannabis policy bill. It's not perfect yet. And the answer is it ain't going to be perfect. There is no perfect. That's not how policy works. Policy is either over or under inclusive. There is no drawing the line perfectly. Like that's not an option. And you know, like you said, we run alcohol bills. Every legislature in every state across the country has at least one alcohol bill run every year. We're tracking 9 cannabis bills in Colorado this session alone. That's a lot for Colorado because we have a limited number of bills each senator or representative can file. That's actually like a lot of legislation on a particular topic. Wow. And we're going to continue to see that. We see it every year. And not only will you not get it perfect, we learn more about cannabis policy. Like what we thought was best practice in 2014 is not best practice in 2021. And it's not going to be best practice. 2021's best practices aren't going to be in 2028. So stop fighting about whether your bill is perfect or not, because it's not. That's it. It's just, and even if you think it is today, you're going to look back 10 years from now and be like, damn, that was not perfect. So get something passed. Because I almost like cannabis. You talked about delivery and hospitality. Those are two of my favorite things in cannabis policy. I call that the fun stuff. But like, you don't get to dessert if you don't eat your vegetables. I mean, that's how it worked in my house. Like you better eat your, eat your protein, eat your vegetables. That is the basic legalization bill. Then we can start nerding about hospitality. That's our dessert. Like, you know, that stuff can come.
Exactly. But you don't have any oil to infuse stuff with if you haven't figured out your cultivation, manufacturing, and retail folks first. And And I think, again, yeah, you've got to get the basics right. You got to get your entree correct, and then you can come back around for, you know, your dessert and aperitif and all of that fun stuff afterwards.
So let's wrap with one question, right? Let's wrap with one thing. And this is a great way. And then I would, yeah, let's absolutely have you jump back on down the line once this thing passes and we start to see. But what is your forward-looking prediction for the future? Like, how is this going to play out in conference committee? Just not like the next 20 years of cannabis policy, but like the next few weeks in Virginia, what should we expect and what should we be watching for to make sure we're kind of know so that we're in the know, and that we know most importantly, when is the day when are we going to be ready to celebrate? Like, oh damn, Virginia got across the finish line.
So it'll probably be mid-March before we'll really know, because that will be veto session. So we'll know if the governor's got any final amendments and all of that fun stuff. My prediction for conference, I think we're going to get something done. I think we will, at the very minimum, have a cannabis regulator established and see expungements and addressed. That is my fervent hope, because that is the literal bare minimum to get this program up and running and to do right by Virginians. And so I hope that we see a minimum viable product pass this year so that we can all get to work on actually making this program reality and be ready to come back again next year to improve it. And I think that's doable. I never underestimate the power to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, but I think that we have a pathway here and it can get done. And we've got a lot of momentum from bill sponsors and the governor who want to see this happen. So I'm hopeful.
Awesome. Well, Niggas, first of all, above all, thank you so much for the work that you do. I don't think folks in our world get thanked enough for kind of changing the world and making it a better place. We're just looked as like kind of business folks. And it's just like, there is a business end to this. Like, we believe in the business, but like, I firmly believe ending cannabis prohibition can change the world for the better. And so thank you for all of the work that you do on this. And thank you for all of the great stuff. And of course, thank you for coming on the Weed Walks and sharing all this great information with me and our listeners. And we look forward to having you on again to talk maybe about Virginia. And then maybe we can dive into some other states, because I know, although we just focused on Virginia today, you do have your fingers into different pots and things like that. So let's do that. And, I can't wait to have you on again.
Sounds great. I can't wait to be back.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Stay nerdy, everybody.
All right, Shay, make the magic.